This week is Halloween. It's one of my favorite holidays. There's a great thrill in going out into the world, dressed up in something strange.
Trick-or-treat.
And yet, before kids rang doorbells to collect their precious candy, Halloween was in fact a Christian holiday that sprang from the end of the harvest season, the beginning of the darker part of the year. My name is Edward Champion, and this is the Bat Segundo Show. This is the first of two shows looking at Halloween from different vantage points. We'll be releasing our second show in a few days on Halloween proper, but in this program, we will examine how America is in denial about its relationship with the dead and its ineluctable religious roots. Over the course of a few centuries, prayers for the dead transformed into less uptight celebrations of ghosts, witches, and zombies. Something solemn became something quite joyful. But what candor did we lose in this transformation? Well, it turns out that Paul Harding's new book, Enon, actually looks into some of these questions. His second novel deals with a man, Charlie Crosby, who was grieving for his lost daughter. But Harding is very interested not so much in the Kubler-Ross model, but in how grief creates desperate associations with our early years. Charlie is someone who projects his own personal history onto the small town where he lives. He sees ghosts. He sees holes. And all this makes Enon something of a spooky excavation of how little we're willing to acknowledge the American relationship to impermanence. But let's let the conversation speak for itself. Here is Paul Harding. Okay, so I am here once again with Paul Harding, who is most recently the author of Enon. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm great. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too. So, I actually have to ask about Charlie Crosby. I mean, he is the protagonist of Enon.
Yeah.
He appeared in an early part of Tinkers, where he is seen reading as a child to his grandfather,
right.
who's George Washington. And in Enon, he calls himself a reader's reader, yet we are not really entirely sure what kind of scholar he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether he's professional or some sort of amateur autodidact. So I'm wondering, you know, to what extent did you map out the Crosby family, and is there room for a Kathy Lee or a David in the family line?
Well, you know, I sort of improvise things as I go along, because I think actually, technically, I fudged the family a little bit, because in Tinkers, I think Charlie has a brother.
Oh,
named Sam. And I pulled the Faulkner, Yoknapatawpha card.
Yeah.
And, you know.
How very portentous of you.
Well, but, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, the Quentin Compson of Absalom. Absalom is not the Quentin Compson of Sound of the Fury. And so I keep these characters all in this loose fictional world, in this fictional family. But I never sacrifice the story to, you know, the rigors of genealogy, you know. And I think you hit the term right on the head. I think of him as kind of an autodidact.
Yes.
Which is a little bit better than a dilettante, you know, but he's just not particularly.
Let's actually defend the dilettantes.
I know.
Paul. I mean, they are, after all, your readers.
Right. We're all professional dilettantes.
We're all dilettantes.
Yeah, that's funny. We're dilettantes today. So, but yeah, you know, I just think of him as just, you know, reading a lot on his own. And
okay. This book reminded me of two other books. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you've read them. Mark Sloka's Brewster, which came out earlier this year, mm-hmm. which dealt with grief by looking at it from a long distance ahead. It was set place in the 1960s.
Uh-huh.
There's another book, which you must read. Both of the books are great, but mm-hmm. Ross Raisin's Waterline. Are you familiar with that?
No, I haven't heard of either
of
those
books.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
This book is about a guy. He loses his wife. He's a Scottish guy. He's unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up, you know, getting on a bus and working in a London hotel restaurant and gets totally exploited and then actually ends up drifting into homelessness.
Sounds like another musical comedy of a novel. No,
well, exactly. So you have written a book. I mean, I'm talking about one book that deals with grief as a surrender of time, which is Brewster.
Mm-hmm.
And with Waterline, it's a book that deals with grief as a capitulation of place.
Right.
You've written a grief novel, if we can call it that, if that's a genre, that involves the surrender of both time and place. There are porous months that just flit right by,
mm-hmm.
Often because of Charlie's
blackouts with pills and whiskey. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why you think Grief and Fiction seems to explore this erosion of time and space more than real life. Was this one of the appeals of working on Enon? Or?
I think it has to do, in my instance, I mean, it has to do with the way that I sort of line up what I think of the subjects and predicates, you know, when you're writing narrative fiction. So I don't think of myself as having written a book about grief. It's I wrote a book about Charlie who's grieving.
Yeah.
So that, because the danger is if you make, and just this is just the danger from the end of like writing fiction.
Sure.
Which is if you, for me, if you think of grief thematically or objectively, as it were, the danger is that then you'll spend all of your time making your character conform to your preconceived ideas of how grief is experienced.
Yeah.
And so I think of the books that I write as very, if not anything else, experiential, you know. So the hallmark of fiction is character. The hallmark of character is consciousness. The hallmark of consciousness is the experience of being in time.
Just so long as there's no Hallmark cards.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
It's like it's too cliche right, here with the conversation.
I'll give you three, for five.
You get three hallmarks.
Right. But so the whole idea is that, you know, time accelerates or decelerates or explodes or compresses according to Charlie's experience of it. So then I'm not imposing any of my preconceived notions about like what happens when you're grieving onto him. And then I just sort of followed his lead in terms of what he found himself thinking about when I gave him the resources of knowing the town's history and all that sort of stuff. Then he was able to superimpose his daughter, the memory of his daughter, in with all the different compounded times of the town. And just, I think of all these things as almost like Perseus and the mirror. You know, he can't look at Medusa. You can't look at the tragedy head on, or you'll perish. You'll turn to stone. So all of these other narratives, these other books, these other the history of the town are things that I give him through which he mediates the memory of his daughter, so he can try to negotiate it and be equal to it without basically doing himself in.
Yeah. You know? But it is interesting that you have to choose. I mean, here's the thing. You write fiction, you're trying to align life to a narrative. But in the case of grief, you actually have to choose far more than a lot of other life experiences in fiction.
Mm-hmm. And it's more extreme.
And I'm wondering, you know, what you do to account for things you can't include, for choices you have to make. It seems to me like it would be a much harder proposition as a fiction writer.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's when I first got the idea for the book, I thought, oh boy, great. You know, it's like a spooky Hawthorne-esque kind of Emily Dickinson, you know, like the kind of first person death poem, you know, posthumous poems and everything. And then within writing half a page of the book, I realized, wait, this is incredibly tragic and you're going to have to think about...
You thought it was going to be a barrel of laughs.
Well, you know, I thought it was going to be like a Halloween spooky ghost story. But of course, the premise then is much more sort of, there's an immediately, you know, sort of, it's much more tragic. And so, I mean, I thought more about Greek tragedy, and Shakespearean tragedy, and just the myths Orpheus and Demeter and Persephone, all these things about a grieving parent like going down to the underworld to fetch back a child, and it was, I mean, it turned out to be just an incredibly difficult subject to write about, but to me that was also kind of almost a guarantee of quality control. If you're writing a story about a parent who's suffering the loss of a child, You take one false step in any direction and you've got melodrama, sentimentality, maudlin, you know, just sort of wringing cheap emotion out of the, you know, inherently sad kind of tragic nature of things. So just as a writer, I was just interested in trying to rise to that occasion, trying to write the novel that I felt like I was actually not good enough to write when I started it.
So this is interesting, because if melodrama is always the risk in looking at a death poem or looking at grief, well, in this case, what's remarkable about Charlie is that he doesn't really, at least audibly, beat himself up. He certainly does it with the pills, with the whiskey and all that. But he never really gets beyond that first stage of grief of the Kubler-Ross model.
Never heard of it. Yeah. You know, that's the thing, is the Kubler-Ross. That's been a subsequent description, which is sort of interesting. But I see him as wrestling with his conscience. I see him as essentially being very aware of the fact that he's sort of ashamed of who he's become since she's died. And then it gave that gave me an opportunity to explore what I find, you know, another sort of universal kind of human, dramatic human predicament, which is not doing as the right thing. Yeah. Knowing what the right thing is and not being able to do it. So him understanding that sort of being on the couch and being paralyzed and becoming addicted to drugs and then breaking into people's houses,
yeah.
he understands the whole time that that's wrong.
Yeah.
And yet he can't stop himself.
But he is in that sort of denial stage pretty much for this 1 year of grief.
I suppose that's one way of looking at it. Yeah, I hadn't, you know, it's I just saw it as him being, him having his attention on, I mean, yeah, I guess maybe if he's denying other things, it's because they're at the expense of what he finds most important and most pressing about.
Yeah,
you know, about the experience.
Why didn't he get angry over this? I mean, he's a very.
I think
very,
he's angry. Yeah. He, you know, he breaks his hand. He punches window.
That's
he
true.
Breaks his hand. You know, he's not a particularly violent guy. You know, so I think the anger is sort of, I think it's diffused again by his conscience. So I think it's a subtle sort of thing. But it's funny because I did, you know, I had a scene in the book, in an early draft of the book, where he sort of runs through the house and breaks the whole house to pieces.
Wow. Yeah.
And it never seemed authentic.
Yeah.
You know, he's just a kind of more, you know, the, you know, more Thoreau, you know, the lives of quiet desperation. It's, the drama is interior with him.
Yeah.
You know, and so the anger is sort of more diffused. Again, I think it's sort of refracted prismatically through his conscience, so it's sort of dispersed in kind of a subtler way.
But here's the weird thing about when he punches the wall with his hand. As a reader, I was very well aware of the many holes in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And by holes, I mean literally just tons of holes. There's everything from the cribbage board to the golf course to, of course, the holes in the cemetery to the holes in that he punches into the wall.
And then he cuts a hole in the wall at the end.
There's that. To the hole in the caretaker's throat. I mean,
that's funny. Yeah.
I mean, it's because this book is so, for lack of a better word, hole happy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that gesture of him smashing the wall as an absolute indignant one, even though it is. But at the same time, it just seems to be that is his way of connecting with his home and all
Could
that.
Be, yeah. It's a sort of cathartic moment then.
Yeah. Well, what of all the holes and how, I mean, the landscape in this book is just utterly porous, and I was wondering about that, why it ended up that way. It seems to me there was no conscious.
Your guess is as good as mine. Yeah, I know. I mean, that happened to me, you know, with Tinkers. I realized that the book was kind of composed of a series of houses that were imperiled and sort of where nests are disappearing or falling, and I didn't consciously put that in the book. And so here, I mean, this, it makes sense. It's, you know, the portal between this life and the next.
Yes.
Through their doorways, I suppose, you know. And he spends a lot of his time trying to sort of break through the doorways or climb down through the grave or something like that. And I really had, the sort of guardian angel of the book was Emily Dickinson, and the way that she sort of crosses through the portals or the rabbit holes or whatever between this life and an imagined metaphysical sort of realm past this life. So I suppose that, I guess, inevitably then, those sorts of things, that verbiage and imagery would naturally sort of precipitate into the language.
And yet, dashes really aren't that much of a part of this book, despite
no,
that.
No, not this time.
Yeah. I'm also curious because we're never really sure where Charlie's life as a house painter ends and where whatever he does for a living begins. Mm-hmm. I mean, he spends much of this novel, he's groping around for shards of his life. Mm-hmm. There's this talk about his early days with the guys. But I'm wondering, you know, why his life isn't terribly defined by work. He mentions not having health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to live off half the $20,000 that comes in from the insurance company.
For that year.
Yes,
yeah.
For that year. I'm wondering, you know, in dealing with this character, were you responding in any way to the kind of spate of unemployed men in America in post 2008? We don't have any sense of what his identity is.
I just was not interested in socioeconomics. Yeah. You know, I mean, I on the one hand, I know lots of guys and sort of existed my, you know, landscaping,
yeah,
house painting, kind of just you sort of take it as it comes. And you could sort of, you know, exist that way in a very modest way. And then again, yeah, I just sort of wasn't. I sort of wasn't that. It's just like the depth of field on which I was operating was much more. I just wanted to put him in this kind of existential situation and not worry too much about, you know, him paying the bills and all that sort of stuff. You know, I don't know. You know, in a certain way, I don't see my books as being, you know, operating in the realm of realism. Yeah. You know, they're mythological. They're sort of. They're otherworldly in a way, you know, in the way that, say, you know, Cheever, you know, like,
yeah,
for all the middle class of a Cheever, you know, people, you know, never paid the bills, you know. I think, like, my favorite Cheever story, The Jewels of the Cabot, the guy says, you know, I write an edition of the New York Times. And he never says, like, well, that's weird. Like,
yeah,
who writes an edition? And, you know, you don't question that. You know, it's just part of the terms that the story presents as its own. That you know, if you don't consent to them, then the story doesn't work. But if you consent to them, then the story gives you its own priorities, its own subjects. So with that, I just sort of felt like, you know, yeah, he just sort of strings it together and spends a year working on a landscaping crew and then spends a year working on a painting crew. And sometimes he heads them and sometimes he's part of them. And that's, you know, I just kind of wasn't interested in the nuts and bolts of all that, you know.
But I guess this is part of what grief is. I mean, it comes, oddly enough, from a life that is devoted to leisure. And in the process of coping with loss, you may not necessarily see the impact this is going to have on your work life, mm-hmm, or on your family life or something like that. And this, I suppose, is why you kind of played down the vocational aspect of this character?
Or? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, I just thought of it as he has a, you know, he's a very modest kind of working class guy, you know, comes from a lower middle class family. His, you know, he and his wife live in sort of in a kind of, you know, a modest house.
Yeah.
And so it's not something that would have been, you know, he's not ambitious in that way. And so, and then they have a daughter and they're living this sort of modest life. And then the most remarkable thing in his life becomes the loss of that daughter. And so then as he carries forward the loss of his daughter, he's not even, you know, because he's telling the story to the reader in retrospect.
Yeah.
So what he would choose to talk to the reader about is not like, oh, and so this is how I paid the electric bill kind of thing. You know, like it's because at that point I'm just thinking, you know, I'm not writing actuarial tables here. It's sort of, it's just, I'm interested in like the kind of emotional experience of this guy.
Yeah.
You know,
there's also this odd character, Frankie. I mean, he's this dealer. He makes these trips to New Mexico to score.
Yeah.
Very easy writer, therefore. it is interesting that he would be more of a fixer for Charlie than any of these self-reliant guys who are working these day jobs. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, when Charlie meets Frankie late in the book, I don't think this gives anything away.
No.
We come to see what the real extent of his relationship to Frank is.
Mm-hmm.
And with this other guy, Scruff.
Yeah.
Given the way that fantasies seem to infuse this guy's existence, I'm wondering, you know, first of all, how much can we trust Charlie at that particular moment? And can we really buy Charlie as a reliable narrator? Or does this dream-injected perspective, maybe this is truer in a way than the realism? I mean, you were saying earlier that you're not really a realistic guy. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I mean, there's no, the book, from Charlie's point of view, or even from any sort of greater narrative point of view or authorial point of view, I think, you know, doesn't give the reader any reason to doubt the veracity of Charlie's narrative. I feel like any of the ways that you're supposed to doubt the narrative, Charlie gives you, you know?
Yeah.
And again, so it's because I didn't want the reader doubting any of the facticity of what, and so what he does is very straightforward. He goes to the bar, gives the guy money, gets the drugs, and then kind of floats away on cloud nine sort of thing. But, you know, I also just think the idea, you know, the sort of generic term of unreliable narrator, the danger with that is that, the way that problematizes characters too often is that there's an implicit, if not explicit, understanding that unreliability is a mark of bad faith or dissembling. Charlie tells his story in good faith. He does not dissemble. It's, you know, I think of it as confessional. It's like St. Augustine, you know.
Well, just to be clear, Paul, you're talking to a guy who actually likes unreliable narrators.
Oh yeah. No. This is just by way of saying that. Like, this is definitely a theme of which I was consciously thinking about and fascinated by, because so the unreliability. Like, I think of him as reliable, at least in, like, he is always going to tell you accurately what his experience of something was.
Yeah.
Which does not mean that he is self-aware. You know what I mean? It does not mean that he can see himself in the world and place himself. He intuits, maybe, that, like, I'm in bad shape, I'm in rough shape, and then these other people walk on stage, and the reader can see, can sort of triangulate just how bad a shape he's in. And so he's not a reliable portrayer of his own position in the outside world, but in interior, which is where, you know, in the inside, the experientially, he's just handing out descriptions of his own experience of grief and the attempts to be equal to it in some modest way.
But I mean, is anybody really truly reliable?
No,
when we are the heroes of our own story? I mean, you know, yeah. I'm wondering how important a point reliability is in terms of relating grief, because you're dealing with a lot of unexpected emotions when you lose someone who is so close to you.
Yeah, he's scrambling.
And so, as a result, anything pretty much should go. And therefore, no matter how fantastical or how dreamlike your story is, it's still going to be very emotionally reliable, even if it doesn't adhere to facts.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the way I think of it, because it's just, I don't know, reliability. Yeah, reliability becomes, if you're thinking about it, you know, in terms of a protagonist, in terms of a first-person narrative, reliability almost comes, or unreliability comes to be almost a kind of synonym for subjectivity.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, I'm not writing objectively about grief. I just don't care about that. You know, like, I just, to me, that would be the highway to being pedantic or being, you know, reductive or something like that. So yeah, I'm like, reliability. I mean, he narrates in good faith, and then to me, it's sufficient to just see what it is he does, because it, you know, the book goes from at the beginning, when he's sort of describing his family life. He uses very conventional language. He just talks, and you know, the conversations he has with his daughter are sort of very quaint, simple, kind of gentle. He tries to, the dialogue is sort of very, very recognizable. That's almost realistic or something like that, you know, or even sentimental. But the point is that you know, before this tragedy, he uses a kind of language that everybody would recognize as being sort of everyday, ordinary. It's recognizable. He can describe his modest life, his modest job, his modest marriage, and the modest pleasures he has of parenthood in very immediately recognizable common language. Then the tragedy befalls him, and suddenly none of that language that he has is adequate to describe his experience. So then he begins trying to improvise out of the modest resources. And so part of what I became interested in anyways as I was writing the book was watching him take these things like the normal history of a little colonial town and start to try to, like, it starts to bend and warp and break apart.
Yeah.
And he tries all these, he improvises all these constructions and collages things out of these fragments and tries to put them together so that he can tell himself the story of his daughter. And they all they fail. They all inevitably fail.
Well, but he's also projecting his personal history onto the history of the town, which is extraordinary. I mean,
absolutely.
But he's also forced to compare the absence of his family along the way to the absence of another man's family. I think of Manprasad, this convenience store clerk. He tells Charlie he hasn't seen his family in India for years.
Yeah.
And then Charlie comes to understand through this very unusual human connection that, well, which, by the way, is predicated on a lie of buying coffee for the guys.
Right, yeah,
He understands, he knows nothing about India. But what's also interesting is that, you know, he also, he says at one point that he can't use the word man in everyday vernacular, and what is Manprasad short for but man? Exactly. Or, and take one letter away from Maine, you get man.
Right.
So the question I have is, you know, why, in that act of projection, he comes to lie further, and he doesn't really quite understand the extent to which he is lying and the extent to which he just can't actually come to terms with his own ignorance on the historical level.
Yeah. Well, I think about that in terms of, he's just mortified. He's just totally self-conscious of that failing. And by that point he's so unraveled and he's so on, you know, so screwed up on drugs and everything that he sort of just keeps, and I think he says it somewhere, where every time he tries to gain clarity, he just wakes up into another order of dream.
Yeah.
And he really does just become disoriented in the deepest sense, you know, emotionally, psychically, all that sort of stuff. So that even when he gets to the point where he wants to be reliable, say, it's a process that it takes a number of stages for him to sort of surface back into anything like the real world. And that's sort of why I felt like sort of at the end of the book, it's sort of enough that he's sort of almost like in his monk's cell, just like trying to keep his shit together, So
I also wanted to talk to you about dreams in this. At one point he says something like the actual world began to revolve itself out of the oneric morass in my skull.
Mm.
It is fascinating that Charlie only seems to have dreams and fantasies of Kate to draw on. There's one, of course, or there's three Kates actually running around.
That's right, yep.
But he doesn't actually directly condemn himself, as I was saying earlier, for Kate's loss. At one point, Mrs. Hale, at the end of the book, tells him, a year is enough! No more grieving.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm wondering, do you feel that a community, whether it be something psychiatric or religious, should enforce how the individual grieves? Is this the stumbling block, the wall that any griever is going to come across?
No, I don't. Yeah. It's certainly nothing I would ever prescribe. I mean, I think it arose as just a consequence of how the elements of the story were working them out. And I think he was looking for that sort of external sort of somebody to say, this father and no more. And that's sort of something that he couldn't do for himself.
Yeah.
And so he was receptive to it. And this Mrs. Hale, who he sort of thinks of as she's the sort of matriarch, the old matriarch of the town, or she becomes this sort of concentrated or distilled kind of ambassador for all of the things, all of the better values that he, if he can't actually articulate for himself intellectually, he senses on an intuitive or aesthetic level all the best things about the town. He, by the time he runs into her, sort of is willing and is susceptible to, you know, her effectively representing all the best things that he thinks about the town.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because if a community should not enforce some sort of moral standards, I'm wondering to what degree Charlie should be pardoned for his fantasies and his dreams. If that is his way of coping, if that is his way of getting back, why should Mrs. Hale go ahead and say, 1 year is enough? I mean, that's, you know,
I think because she knows that he's, you know, housebreaking and, you know, he's falling apart with the drugs and that it's basically he's self-destructive.
Yeah.
But then he's actually becoming destructive of other people's lives.
Sure,
the violence of his grief is starting to leak out into the greater community. And so I think that's then when the community, you know, as it were, I mean, this is sort of speaking about it abstractly, you know, but that's when some voice from the outside has to insist. But I think of it as still being, you know, her being kind of, you know, representative of this milieu of the old Protestant I and thou, you know, you know, the idea that sort of up until that point, the town is somehow still sort of taking care of him and is still sort of, or just, he's still within the boundaries of the town and there's a tactfulness about it. They are sort of letting him go through his own experience of it. But then again, when it starts to sort of break out and sort of infect the rest of the village, he's sort of answered back. He gets sort of pushed back that way. And again, as I said, by that point though, he's receptive to it. He's willing to be sort of ministered to, as it were.
Yeah. Well, you said earlier you didn't really want to write any kind of socioeconomic novel, but this is very much the way America deals with problems. This notion of, well, someone is grieving, we leave them alone, it festers, and only until it becomes a problem for us do we actually intervene. And I'm wondering, you know, how much of American grief can really be kind of categorized in that kind of way, and why it seemed to manifest itself in this way through Charlie.
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't think in terms of American grief, I think in terms of Charlie. And then just, you know, then this, because it's more ad hoc, you know, in this instance. I don't see the town as having this sort of collective sort of, you know, here we are. Okay, so we've got to the 10th degree of Charlie's grief, and now we understand that in the
bylaws. I'm not suggesting there's some sort of, like, you know, odometer here for grief or anything, but I am saying that, you know, just on an intuitive level, we can't recognize someone may need some help, we need to step in, it could be a problem later, even though it's not directly affecting us now, maybe it will, but even more important than that, this guy is hurting, you know?
Yeah, that's a real difficulty. I mean, I think that that's the real irreducible difficulty of grief. That's the, you know, all humans have to figure out. It's all attempts at being equal to grief are improvisations, sort of, because there is that, people want to be solicitous, but they don't want to be intrusive, you know, and that comes out of, you know, good impulses. You know, because we all know that even our best impulses often enough just end up in a catastrophe.
Yeah,
you know,
we don't.
He doesn't need anybody's ill will. You know, like the goodwill sort of strings him along. You know, so it's to me, it's just sort of it's on a case by case basis. You know, and this is just how it happened to play out in this book as I sort of worked on it over the years, and the various elements out of which it was composed sort of aligned themselves and asserted themselves at different places in the book.
I'm curious about this book's military imagery. I mean, there's the early section where Charlie is describing the Memorial Day parade, the soldiers delivering speeches, the words of which were not as important as the spirit in which they were delivered.
Yeah.
You have Aloysius, the cemetery gatekeeper, his caretaker, and it seemed that Aloysius was in fact some archaic military experiment gone awry. Soldiers obviously have to deal with death. Charlie is battle-scarred over his loss. But their grief and the grief of families in terms of the military, that's considered part of the job description. Was the idea here in some way to explore the emotional parallels between the military grief and civilian grief in any way? Or?
No, because I just wouldn't, I don't have any experience of military grief, and I would never, you know, presume then to write about it with any kind of understanding. So no, really where all that comes from is the, you know, the book, the initial idea for the book presented itself as, you know, basically Charlie in that cemetery late at night, you know, amongst all the gravestones, sort of making his way back home after a night of misadventure. So I just started thinking about what I knew of the graveyard in my own hometown. Most of my familiarity with which comes from my years playing in the local marching band on Memorial Day. So that's the day where all the flags are on the veterans' headstones. You have some member, you know, some retired officer comes and gives a speech which you can never hear from, you know, far and farther away because they have the cheap podium speakers. Yeah. But you get the cadence of the speech. It's the kind of, you know, it's patriotic. It's the, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so those things just inevitably just naturally arose out of the fact that all the veterans in any small town across any, you know, the world are buried in the local cemetery. And since this is a colonial town, you actually have the veterans from Iraq and Korea and Vietnam and, you know, World War II, World War I, the Civil War, the Revolutionary War. So it's just, I just thought of it almost as just the strata, part of the inevitable strata of the town's history.
Yeah. The last time we talked about the influence of Marilyn Robinson upon your work. I wanted to actually get into this a little bit in relation to Enon. You have the town paper as the daily bread.
That's a little
explicit there. There's this moment with Mrs. Hale that we've been talking about where she sounds very much like a preacher.
She's absolutely. Old Testament too.
Oh yeah, exactly. Of course. Fire and brimstone. But by and large, it's interesting that Charlie's journey here is largely secular. He does say, "I was never good at math or logic," and I'm wondering, you know, were there early drafts of this where you tried to introduce more religion to explain the kind of spirituality that Charlie is contending with here?
Not particularly. I mean, I think as with, you know, any part, you know, part of the you know, the substance and the challenge and therefore the interest in the work was as an author having more theology than my character had. And I didn't want to devote a lot of pages of prose to getting the cogs and the gears of like, oh, but I was an amateur and I read a lot of theology. Let him start quoting, Karl Barth or something like that. So it was just interesting to figure out different ways. You know, I have him aware of the fact that his great-great-grandfather or whatever, the guy from Tinkers, was a minister.
Yes.
And so that then any kind of, you know, some theology would have been you know, circulating in the family because of this that lineage. It's also kind of in the water over there.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I mean, if you grow up in these little villages, you know, even if it's as attenuated as you get it kind of through your Emerson, you know, Emerson comes directly out of Calvinism.
Yes.
You know, and he, even though he's popularly thought of as having left the church, there are sound theological grounds for arguing that he left the church in order to find God. You know, so there's this sort of, it's just kind of, it's just the milieu of the area. Even people like Hawthorne or Emily Dickinson, who were not comfortable
yes.
with, you know, Emily Dickinson called herself a no-hoper.
That's right.
You know, their verbiage and their milieu is still absolutely biblical.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just kind of interesting and a challenge to figure out different ways to give him some of those ideas and some of even just the morality, the kind of secularized versions of something like character. He really thinks I should have stronger character, you know, just because my child has died doesn't mean I'm no longer a parent.
Yeah.
You know, I would have never acted this way if she was alive, but now that she's dead, I'm still a parent, but how is it that I've just fallen apart like this? He's dismayed. So he thinks about those things without having to be able to sort of cite chapter and verse. And then what I was able to do is when Mrs. Hale comes on stage, she just speaks in Old Testament biblical. She speaks in William Tyndale's
yes.
English.
Yes.
You know, which is, you're the maker of strange days and the... No, you're a maker of dismal days and a burner of strange fires. Straight out of like Deuteronomy,
yeah.
you know, which is the idea that you're sacrificing, you know, burning strange fires in the Bible refers to the habit that the Jews were trying to sort of get out of their culture of when something went wrong, you sacrifice your children
yeah.
in the fire to Moloch, you know, so just that idea that that rings through the story too, the idea that he pitches his daughter into the fire.
Yes.
But somehow or another, that's, you know, it's very, very sort of.
Sounds very like the Aztecs.
Yeah. But it is. And it's very sort of, you know, so in his, I mean, in strict terms, you'd think of it, it's pagan. You know, that's why the Christians didn't like. But just in, I mean, for me, it just worked kind of in more general mythological terms.
Yes.
Just the idea of like taking the memory of your daughter and burning it, throwing it away, tossing it in the fire, and him kind of realizing that's kind of what I'm doing, and yet. The only way I can see my way into still being with her is he improvises this modest little pagan religion based on the worship of the dead.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like he idolatrizes, you know, he turns her into an idol and makes these little fetishes out of her. And each one for a minute he thinks, oh, I get, you know, but it's almost like the drugs he's taken. Like,
yeah.
You no sooner assemble this idol or this voodoo doll or whatever out of your daughter, and you no sooner think there she is, that it falls apart in the making. Like no sooner is it made than it falls, and he understands that, and but he can't kind of get out of that jam, sort of. And that ended up for me becoming the central. That's the heart and soul of the book, is him getting into that sort of that weird sort of. So then he imagine he's scooping up the coffee, and he finds himself imagining it's like her ashes.
Yes,
and he has this whole elaborate fantasy about making coffee or tea out of her ashes and drinking it as this sort of like weird ritual that might in some cultures be the most profound sacred thing, but then he really knows. For me to be thinking about that,
this is
quite morbid, you know.
So it seems that what you were trying to do here, in some sense, and this also kind of carries over from Tinker's, is to point to the reality that all of American life comes from Calvinism, comes from some sort of religious origin. And no matter where we are, whether we are wild-eyed atheists or whether we are deeply pious, we have to come to terms with our history like this, no matter what. Even in our expression of grief, in our reading, in our walking down the street, going to get our pills from the guy from New Mexico, whatever.
Yeah,
all part of that. And if we want to be honest and true to ourselves, we have to confront that.
Well, I think, at least sort of in the original 13 colonies, sort of, you know, because I think as you get out west, the much more Catholic.
Well, I'm a California
and
guy.
California.
But this interests me,
But I do think it's true that whether you like it or not, it is your inheritance out here, you know, to some extent. Because it's just, you know, I didn't even know what it was that I was missing out of writers like Faulkner and Melville and Dickinson and Hawthorne until I went back and read Calvin and Jonathan Edwards, and then even Karl Barth, even though Karl Barth's Swiss, but that tradition of thinking, which I think in aesthetic, poetic, narrative terms.
Yes.
You know, I think of these cosmologies that they, you know, the stories and Christ and all this sort of stuff. Those are stories that are, they're narratives. They talk about narrative truths. You know, they talk about, they don't actually in the theology, you know, in say evangelical theology, they're thought of as normative and yeah. therefore sacred and holy, but they're not fundamentalistic.
Yes.
They're not fundamentalist. They none of the theology I read ever make, you know, ever hangs any of its real substance on anything being literally true, you know? So then you get, I think, you know, it just spirals off into these completely irrelevant arguments between science and religion, you know, like claiming that, you know, claiming that you need to, in order to verify, you know, the story of Noah, you'd have to find the ark, is like objecting to Moby Dick because they can't find the Pequod.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Moby Dick is true, right? It's true. It's not factual, right? You know what I mean? And so, anyway, that's sort of slightly off topic. But I do think that that's what I find in my own experience anyways, is that the more I know about that, the more I just understand when I live in my little New England village, like, you know, as Henry James would say, where in a manner of speaking we have got to. You know, because it's still shaped. So you're still shaped by your history, whether you're aware of it or not.
And yet, I would also argue, Paul Harding, that in this book, you prove indefatigably that also the American heritage is bowling. Because you have
what?
Bowling. You have the rat in the bowling ball that is spound. You have the cribbage board that is actually cut from a 10-pin.
A 10-pin,
yeah. That was extraordinary. Yeah. I've never heard of that.
That
may
be my Massachusetts grievance, because, you know, in Massachusetts you can only find candlepin bowling.
Yeah, I know candlepin. I discovered that for the first time several years ago, and it was a delight.
And
yeah.
To my, you know, because
to my California ass, I was like, what the hell is this?
Candlepin bowling is so utterly inferior to 10-pin bowling. So that's maybe my...
But it makes a pleasant sound, you know.
Oh, yeah, I guess it does. Yeah. But I was throwing my arm out because the balls are too light.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
So, yeah, that's really funny. But that's the kind of stuff you do. You find it all the, you know, because that's another, maybe it's more universal, but certainly New England, you know, what you do on Saturdays is you go and you look at all the junk everybody has out on their front yard that they're selling, and you end up with these unlikely little artifacts.
Yes.
You know, flea markets, stuff like that, you know.
Well, I mean, I mentioned sound, and Charlie is very attuned to sound throughout this book. He at one point compares grief to this great organ chord, and I'm wondering, is this largely, I suppose, reflective of trying to find this space of silence for him to have kind of this almost secular prayer for Kate and all that, or
I think of the book as a prayer.
Yeah.
You know? So one of the things, you know, unlike Tinkers, where there are different voices.
Yeah.
You know, I thought from the very beginning, Enon was a solo.
Yeah.
It's one voice. And so it's a lamentation, it's a prayer, it's a psalm, it's a hymn, should be one voice. So I think of it musically.
It's a guitar solo.
Is it right? Yeah, and so he's just, and so he thinks of things musically, I guess, because I think of things musically. And I think of, you know, kind of the fiat lux of the universe in kind of musical terms as well, you know, the idea that, you know, the universe is like a big chord, you know, and you know, it's, this is also, I just, you know, whatever I'm reading, I kind of it in whatever weird kind of strained or transformed shape it shows up, and I just, like, whatever I'm reading always ends up in what I'm writing, you know. So I've just been reading a bunch of was reading some of Charles Rosen, you know, some of his stuff about classical form, and just thinking, like, I don't know anything about musical theory, but, you know, he talks about triadic, you know, and triadic chords and harmony and the circle of fifths and the way that, you know, the way that you create tension and polarity and then, you know, resolution and all that sort of stuff. You know, in my dilettantish, you know, kind of
Paul Harding dilettante.
Paul Harding dilettante. Here we come back to the autodidact. You know, just take all of that and just sort of use it in a very kind of rough, intuitive way, and then just kind of give it to my protagonist to think of it in terms of just like you're in the middle of a chord that's so gigantic you don't know what the shape of it could possibly be, but doesn't change your certainty, your conviction that you are nevertheless still in the middle of it.
Yeah. I also wanted to talk about how homes have transformed from Tinkers to Enon.
Uh-huh.
There is, of course, in both of the books, you know, elements of, I guess, the home is an onion. You peel away certain layers. And Onion is, of course, close to Enoch.
Right.
Where you peel away certain layers and you find elements of history. In this, we have not so much the moving home that is traveling along the road,
right.
but a static home that often disappears, a cabin that may be there or may not be
yeah.
there. And I'm curious about why you kept the homes more static this time. Was it sort of a stylistic limitation? Was the idea to keep Charlie in one place so that he would actually have to wrestle with this solo, with this prayer, with this outpouring of grief and all that?
Yeah, I sort of had to persist because if I sort of unhoused him, he would have to live in a tent in the woods or something like that. But I think you're right. That becomes the site of kind of what's most sacred. It's almost like a, you know, a church or a sanctuary or something to him. Yet at the same time, his memories, the memories that it contains are so harsh that he spends a lot of his time out in the woods, falling asleep out
yes.
in the woods.
Yes.
But then he always has a place, the place to return to.
Yeah.
And there, and again, so there's sort of like that home is there for him, even though he's not aware of its, you know, its consistency in his life. He doesn't experience it as sanctuary, and yet it is his sanctuary.
Yeah, but the Phantom Cabin pertaining to history,
oh, that's right, yeah.
there's that as well, and that to me, I mean, especially when you have the girls who are at the cemetery,
yeah.
this shows that, you know, no place you have is ever going to be permanent, especially when you start looking from a historical lens. So, to do that is absolute folly. I mean, you know, for all we know, this store that we're sitting in right now could be gone in 10 years. Or tar pit, or people like, you know, an e-cigarette joint. Who knows?
It'll be in the ocean.
Right. Yeah.
No, that's absolutely... So when I just think of that, I mean, one of the ways that he thinks of it, because I think of it this way, which is just he thinks of all the different times of the history of the town as sort of superimposed, and yet if you think of them diachronically, you know, it's almost like I just think of a time-lapse photography over centuries.
Yeah.
So, you know, the house comes up and the house goes down, and the tree comes up and the tree's chopped down, and the house comes up and the house burns down, and you're just thinking of, like, the moving pentimenti.
Yes.
Almost, you know, so you think about these homes and the topography on a more, you know, kind of like more geological scale, but all of these things are building up and being eroding and building up and eroding. And so I think of, like, that house in the woods that just disappears. It's just like, yep, yeah, there it was there, and now it's not, because you're not there with it. But that doesn't, you know. And there's the windmill that he says, oh, that was the windmill was over on the golf course.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I mean, just to me, it's part of the fun of narrative is you build this image of a windmill in the reader's mind. Just, it's a minor example in the book, but it's just enough so that, like, there it is. There's the windmill. It's on the hill, and you build it just in order to tell the reader it's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Which then starts to habituate the reader towards the way that time is going to work. So it doesn't feel arbitrary when these things sort of, they show up and they flicker, you know, they disappear. That happens in Tinkers. The house sort of flickers out like a candle going out.
Yes.
And just that idea of, you know, we fret and strut our hour upon the stage, you know, and
the illusion of permanence.
The illusion of permanence. And and there's a great line at the end of one of Cheever's stories, The Day the Pig Fell in the Well, about you know, the last night the family is spending,
right.
you know, in the, I think it's on the porch or whatever, and there they all are with their human troubles and this and that, and nothing could seem more permanent, yet in the morning they'd all be gone. And suddenly the last thing is, so, you know, like a summer home that's been left for the winter. Just hair-raising. It's so poignant and so beautiful. And, you know, so it's totally sad, and yet it's also reassuring because it's like, it's universal to human experience, that being in time. And
but it's one hell of a thing to do, to look to place as a form of, well, maybe a house, maybe a cabin, maybe a windmill, may be around a little longer than someone who walks this mortal coil.
Yeah,
but it's still the same kind of folly. Nothing is permanent. And that is so...
It's just a matter of scale.
Yeah, that's so tragic to me that anyone would do that. And yet, at the same time, I am constantly fascinated with wanting to see certain things I like preserved. And, you know, when I see, like, a cool bar, it's like we apply this ridiculous kind of criteria.
Yeah. And I you know, and it's the same thing, which is, we know it cannot be, and yet that doesn't stop us hoping for it to be. And so then you become, you know, then you're in the aesthetic and whatever spiritual realm of, hope is something that's very, very important to human life.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't think it's deluded to hope. You know, even, you know, you can know something is, you know, who will ever, I mean, that's, the book ends with him saying, you know, anticipating like all of my troubles will just nobody will have ever known about them.
Yeah.
You know, there's something tragic yet hopefully totally recognizable about that, totally moving about it, you know? And I think that's my job. That's why I write books and don't fix sinks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's just what I like to spend my days contemplating.
I wanted to ask also a really quick question about Alosius. Is that a reference to James Joyce's middle name, or?
Oh, no, I didn't know that his middle name was
James,
that. Yeah,
James A. Alosius Joyce.
There is just, that name always showed up, and I can't remember what it was, but it was, everybody I knew always pronounced it Aloysius. And
Aloysius.
I can't remember what it's, I pronounced it Aloysius too.
Aloysius.
And then somebody said, no, it's Aloysius. And I said,
by the way, for listeners, this is the pronunciation of a book reader who doesn't actually, he's too lazy to look up the damn dictionary. No,
and yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah,
exactly. Happens all the time.
It happens to me on a daily basis that I find myself suddenly having to pronounce out loud words that I know very well, but have only ever known as a reader.
Yeah,
you know,
so
I was also informed that it was Aloysius in the similar way somebody said, oh no, it's
Aloysius. All right, Aloysius.
Because I said Aloysius, just wait.
Aloysius.
But I have no idea. You know, it's one of those funny things where I just like, it just sort of came out of the blue. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll go back and I'll change it. And it just stuck in sort of like an interesting name. And, you know, the character is sort of roughly based on a guy who was the caretaker of the cemetery that my mother sort of knew and would chat with when she'd, you know, water the flowers in her parents' grave and stuff like that. So,
One last question, and I wanted to actually get back to this notion of permanence that we were talking about through the photo. I mean, I mentioned the photo of the Indian convenience store clerk, but there's also this July 1890 photo of a boy and girl on Main Street with grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And in his own words, in looking at the photographs of the boy and girl, I mean, he says that he's constantly moving further toward the border between this life and what lies outside it.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of goes into what we were talking about, but I mean, that seems to me a kind of desperation that goes beyond the preservation of physical space and into the photography or the mimesis of physical space, and what someone else has done. It's like he will constantly look for scraps no matter what, even if he's holed up in the house. And, that's got to be, I mean, to my mind, probably one of the saddest ways of pursuing grief, and yet it's emotionally authentic.
In that sense, I guess he's hapless, you know, but in that sense also, it's just that is who he is. That is his natural impulse, is to take whatever craps and scrums he finds, scraps and crumbs that he finds, and
although that's
do this
that's
with,
good too.
He goes looking for crumbs of drugs and stuff like that. But that's what it is. He's just, you know, he lives a modest life, you know. And so this is just what he impulsively and naturally and intuitively does. And, you know, for whatever, however they precipitate in the fiction, you know, I'm just, you know, Charlie, c'est moi, man. You know, like, that's what I do.
Yeah.
I make the novel out of, you know, old town records and books of old photography from the town that a guy named Benjamin Conant actually took. And there actually are these pictures. And so I'm making my novel and I go, look at this. What's this photograph? Who are these two little kids? This is 1890. Wow, I recognize Main Street. That tree's still there. That house is still there. And as I sort of implicate myself in the photograph and sort of imagine my way into that temporal bandwidth of the town, I just give my impulse to my protagonist, and he does the same thing, but with the added sort of aesthetic and dramatic pressure that I've given him in the premise of the book.
Yeah.
You know? And I want to do that too, because like that hometown of mine is the milieu that I have right at my fingertips. So I don't have to stop and I don't have to think, you know, what's it like in Texas in May? You know, I mean, because I felt like I've given this guy such a heavy load, this burden of grief, that I want to make sure that the milieu through which it comes, this local milieu through which it comes, is something that I just have on lockdown. So I can always, in every single sentence, be rightly honed in on his experience of it, rather than kind of like worrying about window dressing or stage decoration.
Well, if we're always drawing from crumbs or
I don't know if we always are. You know, like this guy is.
Yeah, or this guy. Or if we are always drawing from some kind of heritage, well, how would you define originality? What is originality?
I have no idea. I mean, oh, well, okay, maybe because this is the inevitable. It comes experientially. You know, I'm very Kantian that way. You know, I feel like, you know, space and time are physiological properties of the brain.
Yes.
Perceiving, you know, the brain and the self perceives itself as a self existing in space and time. And if that's the case, and if it's true, which I think it is, that like nothing more complicated than the human brain has been observed in the universe, and I, you know, I don't know about this scientifically, but I bet it stands up. The physiology of each person's brain is as unique to them as their fingerprint, then originality really, I mean, you know, here I come. It's my final concluding confession that I'm a humanist through and through. You know what I mean? Like, that goes back to transcendentalism. It's you and your experience of the world, and you're not free to, that gives a value judgment to it, but you are able to be completely unoriginal through your whole life if you choose to be. But you are free to attempt originality by being mindful of things experientially. Like, to me, originality comes in experience and in closely observed experience.
That's a great place to end.
Yeah, that sounds good. I don't think I...
Yeah. Thank you so much, Paul, for squeezing me into your bumper car, bump and grind
session. Likewise to you, man. That was a great pleasure.
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers, because if you do, you can hear there are voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will too, we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free.